Dave. Dave. Can you take one more story from my little vacation in Cancun?
Brad, just hearing you say my little vacation is all I need to get me going in the morning. Yes. Yes, I can take more stories from Chichen Itza. Yes, please.
So we're over in Cancun.
Wait, what is that in the background? What is that noise?
So I've got my alarm clock set to I don't use the alarm clock because buzzing and beeping wakes me up with a real start. So I use the bedtime setting on my iPhone. And do you use this setting, by the way?
Is this a setting that mutes everything, basically, for like an 8-hour period, and you don't get text? Yeah. I use that.
And then instead of being woken up to like, it wakes you up very, very quietly, and then it gets slowly louder and louder with these natural songs. And mine is set to birdsong, which I really like. It's nice, and you just start to hear these little birds chirping away, and that's how I wake up. Well, we're in Playa del Carmen, and it's 3 o'clock in the morning or something, and all of a sudden I get up and start like moving around the room and putting my clothes on, and my wife is like, "What's the matter with you? What are you doing?" And I'm like, "My alarm's going off. It's time to get up." And I said, "It's darker out here than usual, but, you know, we've got a full day of stuff ahead." She goes, "Get back in bed, idiot. Those are real birds."
Oh, my God. I didn't see that coming. It's just the natural sounds of a jungle, and Brad immediately puts his undies on. A bird.
Which usually happens when I hear jungle sounds.
a bird, quick, get my undies on. Oh, God.
There was two choices. You could have ocean view and jungle view. And because jungle view is a little bit more affordable, we choose jungle. But we were right back into a row of trees and stuff. And all of the birds sounded exactly like that. And of course, in Philadelphia, the only birds that generally I hear is pigeons, you know, cooing down on the sidewalk and maybe some sparrows and stuff. And that one hawk. We've got a hawk in our neighborhood that terrorizes the squirrels. Every now and again, it's wonderful to see one of those things swoop down and get one of those little brat bastards.
And God! Oh, jeez! Listen to Brad all of a sudden. Oh, I love to see it. Oh, the death involved is amazing. Oh, the gore. Oh, I love it. I could.
I hate those squirrels. They're just rats with better PR.
A squirrel just screaming for dear life as a hawk flies off, and you just see Brad slowly sipping a coffee with a smile. That's a good Tuesday right there.
Oh, God. Carolyn was driving home one day, and all of a sudden, a squirrel dropped, boom, right onto her windshield, out of nowhere. And the squirrel stops, shakes its head, and kind of groggily tries to run away. And this hawk came down and grabbed it a second time and flew off with it. And she realized that either that the hawk had him, and I'm saying hawk, I think it's a falcon, because I later on I get corrected. My wife loves the show.
This is an important detail to clarify for the squirrel story. Yeah. This is great.
Yeah, because I get notes. I get notes after she. I've got to go through the Carolyn Geiger notes. By the way, I was wrong about the Mayan ball game. It was the losers that got their head cut off. I got that wrong. But anyway, it's a falcon, and that came up and grabbed the squirrel, dropped it on the car first. It was wonderful.
We're learning a lot about Brad Geiger through these Chichen Itza stories, because I love that you're on vacation and you're like, alarm, oh, got a big day, gotta get up, got a bus line I've gotta wait in, let's get going, get moving, come on Caroline, get up, get going, quick, get your undies on, let's get that bus line, we gotta beat the Japanese and the Germans there at 4 a.m.
Do you want to know too much about my life? That was nothing compared to my honeymoon. We spent our honeymoon in Disney World, and I was up at 5 o'clock every morning. And it's like, okay, I've got a whole thing. We're going to walk counterclockwise through the park because all the rooms walk clockwise.
Oh, God, Brad, enjoy a vacation. Bring it down a notch. Just enjoy a vacation, for God's sakes. All right, now listen, I've created 17 quadrants for Disneyland. We're going to be going counterclockwise. We've got to start at 5 a.m. I've installed bathroom breaks every 139 minutes. It's got to be 139 minutes from timeout with the It's a Small World. It's opening and closing. So we've got a fun day ahead of us, but everybody get your shoes on. Everybody get your shoes on. It's 4:30. Come on, let's go. The sun's going to rise in 3 hours.
Oh, she almost divorced me by the time we were midway through the honeymoon.
What a treat to be married to you are. What a treat. Yeah. Well, we're on vacation. Come on now. We've got 2 minutes to have lunch. Let's eat quickly, quickly, quickly. Start digesting. Great.
Oh, and this was, thank God this was before smoochy selfies, you know, because we didn't have to deal with any of that. But yeah, it was a slog,
excuse me, sir.
I'm telling you.
Excuse me, I know you're from Brazil and are currently smooching, but I'm Brad Geiger. I'm on a strict schedule here. Strict schedule. I've got to get to Chichen Itza by 4:39 or else I'm not going to get my afternoon sciatica pills in on time. So I need you to quit smooching. Anyway, I've been Brad Geiger. Sorry to scooch by you. Here we go. You both look lovely. Have a wonderful vacation.
I'll be scooching while you're smooching is what I'll be doing.
I'm just going to apply some more zinc oxide here and check out my own personal calendar map. All right. We're still on schedule, Caroline. We're having a lovely vacation. Quickly, quickly. Come on, pick up the pace, honey. We've got to get going.
Carolyn, don't tally over there with the Brazilian. Come on, we're go. Carolyn? Carolyn?
We don't have time for smooching. No, honey. Get away from me. I did not schedule smooching time. No.
This is not on the itinerary.
Oh, man. I love the idea that you on vacation is like up at 4, crack a dog, yeah. get those shoes on, get moving. Oh, we got it. All right. I've rewritten the schedule to take into account that we might want to say hurrah once or twice.
Yeah, three times as intense as a work day. I when I get back from vacations, usually I'm absolutely worn out. I need a vacation from my vacation because I just went way overboard.
I love it. I'm excited because when you come out here in May for NCS Fest, in some respects, part of it is a vacation, part of it's a working vacation, and yeah. Part of it's a con. But I love the idea that you're going to be on vacation and being like, well, David, this has been a lovely 10 minutes in the jacuzzi. Time to get moving. We're going to get on to our next event, which I believe is me using the restroom and going to bed. All right. So fantastic.
And please remember to exit the jacuzzi in a counterclockwise fashion. That's all the right. Rubes go clockwise.
I've created a map that I've taken the liberty of posting onto your fence. And so this will let us know how to exit the jacuzzi. Here's a firm handshake before we go to bed. Great. This has been a very pleasant vacation.
I didn't even have handshake scheduled until 8 o'clock and it's only 7:55. This has been a good day.
This is how much I'm able to let my hair down. I didn't even schedule this handshake and we're doing it. All right. Well, that's my week of abuse for Brad Geiger. How nice.
And deservedly so, by the way.
Well, listen, I'm going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about squirrels being lifted off and then dropped onto cars by falcons and making comics. Wow, that was chewy. Oh,
wow.
Boy.
Wrestle that one to the ground.
Oh, that joke was a long walk that did not have a payoff. There we go.
And making a living from falcons. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm his friend Dave Kellett, who has scheduled out a very strict schedule for today's Comic Lab. I'm also the cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon. I'm the co-director of Strip. And also, I'm the current Kickstarter at newsheldonbook.com of my next book, but we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, and this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. And Dave, let's talk Kickstarter.
Oh,
see what I did there?
Let's do it. All right, so I started a Kickstarter, Brad, this week. I'm on day 2 officially right now, and it's doing good. It's at 15,000 on day 2, so I'm going to chalk this up as a win.
Yeah, your goal was what?
I set my goal lower than normal to test out something that we can talk about, actually. I set my goal at 8,000, which was just cost of production for that book.
Cost of production only? You didn't factor in stuff like mailing and so on and so forth?
I did not. And I'll tell you why. Knowing that the book would, I know it's going to get at least 35,000 by the time it's all said and done. Mm-hmm. So what I wanted to do was, I had been reading on a couple different sources about how setting an artificially low Kickstarter can actually help game the algorithm, because right now I'm almost at 200%. On day two. And so the algorithm goes, oh, these people are really doing gangbusters. Let's put them a little higher on the... And so it's more of a curiosity. I'm testing it out to see if I notice a difference in terms of placement on the comics subpage or on the Kickstarter mm-hmm. main page as to how the success of the Kickstarter is doing.
Wow.
And I'll report back as we go with the Kickstarter. But for right now, it's doing good. I'm excited with... The being at 15,000, I think just based on my back of envelope projections that it'll end around 40,000, maybe 45,000.
Nice.
So I am perfectly happy with that. That's a lovely Kickstarter for a Sheldon book, and we'll see where it ends up in a couple weeks.
So I wouldn't suggest somebody listening at home to do what you're talking about until they're in the place where they can say what you said. In other words, I know, having done X number of Kickstarters, I know where this one's going to kind of end up.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, and as a reminder, Brad, this is my eighth Kickstarter.
Right.
So, and you, as much as I was making fun about Brad, making fun of Brad for being scheduled on his vacation, I actually am a person that's data driven with these things. And I have, if you were to see my hard drive, I have all sorts of like Excel spreadsheets and visual graphs of how my past Kickstarters have done. So literally, I know by day three exactly how much I'm going to end up with on my Kickstarter. Yeah. Honest to God, yeah. I know a ballpark of within $8,000 how whether I'm going to end up at 35 or 45,000 or 55,000. Anyway.
Yeah.
So to Brad's point, I would not recommend your first, second, third, fourth Kickstarter that you do this. This is just an experiment. Now that I know what I can expect, to see if I can game the algorithm a little bit. But as I said, it's an experiment. And to Brad's point, I would not recommend it if you are starting your first Kickstarter or early Kickstarters. With those, best to stick to an actual number that gets you your cost, gets you your shipping, and gets you a little bit of profit so that it was worth it to have done it. Don't you think, Brad?
Co-signed 100%. And I also want to talk about this. You released the... Kickstarter information, as you've done in the past, to Patreon backers, including, I should add, the Patreon backers of Comic Lab and Patreon backers of Sheldon and Drive. You did a secret opening, and that's a strategy that we've talked about here on the show before. You did a secret opening only for your Patreon backers and gave them a certain number of special offers that were available only to them.
Right.
And using that, and by the way, we've talked about doing that and in the past, and we got a little pushback on it. We had a few people saying, nah, I don't think I'd do that. It's not a great way to game the algorithm and so forth. However, I do have to say that on the first public day of your Kickstarter, you opened having funded well over 100%, and that has got to have a big effect on whether Kickstarter looks at this as something worth promoting, don't you think?
So I'm of two minds about it. I do kind of agree. I think it was Erica Moen that said that she did not recommend the path that I take, which is to release it secretly for 12 to 16 hours just for patrons, right? Which is the way I do it. She was more of the idea that she and her husband like to go full guns blazing. It's released publicly, get it as high as you can in that first day, and in so doing, game the algorithm that way. And I actually understand and I co-sign that. I think that's a smart way to do it. I think that they are clever, and I think you should listen to their advice. I like to do the secret Patreon release. And what I do is I start it at 2 p.m. on a given day, and then at 8 a.m. the next morning, I release it to the public. So I guess that's, 16 hours? Not 12 hours. So 16 hours, many of which are overnight hours. Anyway, the reason why I do that is in the days leading up to it, I publicly say, hey, there's a really secret link coming on Patreon. And in so doing, I actually get more followers on Patreon because people are like, wait, what's coming? What is this? What do I want to sign up for?
Yes.
And so that's a little bit of a loss leader, is that I'm getting people long term by offering this short term discount. And then also, it is a legitimate way to say thank you to people that make Sheldon and Drive and Comic Lab possible with their support on Patreon. So it's a legitimate wanting to do an act of goodwill. And also it's kind of fun in the sense that, like, hey, we're all in this together. Here's a little secret link just for you all. Because legitimately you make my career possible. So thank you. And keep it quiet. Here's a link just for you. And there's something kind of fun about that, you know?
Yeah. And when you share that link, of course, the link you're sharing is newsheldonbook.com. And that's another strategy we've talked about last year, where you bought that URL and you just redirect it to whichever Kickstarter you're working on at the time. So the nice thing about that is all those shows from 2018 where you had your Kickstarter going last year and you talked about newsheldonbook.com. If anybody's listening to one of those shows and happens to put the URL in, or if they find an old link on an old blog post or something like this, all of those links are still good. In fact, they're even better because they point to your new stuff. And anybody using newsheldonbook.com, even if they got it through an old source, is going to get the new Kickstarter because you've gone in and redirected that to the new Kickstarter URL. And I really, really, in fact, that's one I stole from you immediately because I looked at how smart it was for you to use something like newsheldonbook.com and really use that as a redirect for all your new stuff. It keeps your old stuff relevant. And do you have any metrics on how that's working out?
What, with newsheldonbook.com? Well, the thing
with newsheldonbook.com, yeah.
No, I was going to tell you about newsheldonbook.com instead of newsheldon. Yeah. But anyway, here's the easiest metric you need to know. Anytime you're using Twitter or Instagram or Facebook and you just want to mention the Kickstarter,
yeah,
I would normally have to write kickstarter.com/projects/smallfish, which is my company, /pop-culture.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, that's a long walk, even just visually, you know, it doesn't feel clean. It feels like a, what am I clicking here? However, newsheldonbook.com, I'm going to be writing that, honest to God, 400 times over the next 30 days as this Kickstarter proceeds. And so there are times where it's easy to cut and paste the kickstarter.com link, but there's also 101 times and places where just typing out newsheldonbook.com is so much easier. So even without the metrics that you've asked about, I just know that in terms of the logistics of handling a Kickstarter where I'm going to be posting, no joke, on Instagram, Twitter, on Reddit, on my three sites, I guess, on all three of my Patreons, on our Discord server occasionally. Like, there's all these different places that I have to be mentioning things, right? And so just the taking away the hassle where all I have to write is newsheldonbook.com is so much better.
Yeah. No, I agree. That's why I'm such a big fan of newsheldonbook.com.
All right. I see you, Brad Geiger.
And seven.
There's like a little checklist. Well, I see we've done that. All right, moving on. Now it's time for another firm handshake, and we're off on our vacation.
As long as we're doing callbacks from last year, we mentioned that somebody's got to hear something seven times before they react to it. So I was trying to make sure that we had gotten a good, strong seven in there. But having dealt with the number seven, let's deal now, Dave Kellett, with the number five. You know what I'm going to say?
Oh, you know what? I think you're going to say that these are our $5 questions that we get from our wonderful, kind supporters and backers on patreon.com/comiclab. Is that what you're going to say, Brad Geiger?
Yes, yes. And also, because on a scale of 1 to 5, this next Patreon backer, in my estimation, is a solid 5 in terms of what a fine individual they are.
I thought you were going to make it weird and do like a physical rating.
No. Oh, no. I was being very careful.
Like, oh, those legs are a 5. No. Oh, the eyes. I just want to dive in and swim. Oh, look at those eyes.
I was being very careful not to be my usual creepy self. I was saying a 5-star individual out of being a fantastic, awesome person.
All right. Let's hear that question. Bradley J. Geiger, hit me.
All right. MJ says, hi, guys. I'm a longtime listener, first time question asker.
Oh, for God's sakes, question asker. No, MJ, don't support this.
See why I like MJ so much?
Don't support this, MJ.
I've been putting off cover design for my soon-to-be-released comic, Red Smoke. and I need some professional guidance. I was wondering if I could, if you could share your thoughts about what images or composition make an effective cover for a standalone graphic novel. I have a gut feeling that this differs from what might make an effective cover for a collection. Of course, I will take Dave's prior advice, not putting a scantily clad, overweight, elderly man on the cover. And I've already sent my printer an email to find out about cool materials like spot UV and such. But do you have a sense that a single character posing is more effective or striking than a tableau? How much background is too much? Is a significant cover object or prop that features in the story too abstract? On top of that, I'm considering open versus closed composition, font size, dominant color schemes, all of this stuff. I'm probably overthinking it, but I don't want to fall into easily avoidable traps. So let's take a moment and walk MJ through a few do's and don'ts and rules of thumb when it comes to cover design, Dave Kellett. And I'm going to let you start with this because I think your covers are super, super strong.
Oh, Brad, you're now that's just a lie. But all right, I'll start. Okay, so one thing, MJ, that you want to consider, first and foremost, let's just talk about title placement, because for some people, this is very important. Now, if you've ever held a French graphic novel, a bande dessinée novel, if I'm saying that correctly, you'll notice that the author's name is always top center, and the title is either top center or bottom center, right? But in American comics, because of the way that bookshelves or bookstores often shelve a book, which usually involves sometimes if it's front facing out, there's a lip on the bookshelf. Most commonly in the US and Canada, titles are put at the top of a book, right? So that's just getting the most basic thing out of the way. So if you at all want to retail or want a point of purchase book sale, most people would recommend a top of cover title treatment for your book. That being said, my drive book, I know I don't sell into bookstores. So I intentionally wanted a French style book cover with the author name on the top and the title on the bottom. Now, I've limited myself in terms of bookshelving possibilities in bookstores, but I don't care because I kind of don't sell ever in bookstores. Like right. one out of 1,000 of my books is sold in a bookstore. So there was a very specific aesthetic that I went for there. But anyway, so that's just top easy top thing to talk about is title placement. Next, I honest to God would look at the most effective posters that you've seen in your life. A lot of these are the Indiana Jones ones, the Star Wars posters, and then you can start going down through a list of all the most famous ones, the Jaws poster from 1978, all this sort of stuff. And you basically want to ask yourself whether the story you're trying to tell is of a singular character, a hero's journey that we're following, or is it a cast that we're following, or a crew, or that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
In which case, a tableau is more effective. And then for both of those, I would personally argue for the fact that a lot of modern movies are sold based on the face of the actors. So if you ignore that, some of the best classic movie posters all involve an action, not stasis. So my other point is whether you go with a singular character because you're following a hero's journey or a tableau because you're following a crew or a cast, whichever one you go with, I would highly, highly recommend action, kinetics, movement, rather than stasis, which in some of my covers I have suffered from in the past, like the overweight, scantily clad elderly man that you mentioned, who's fairly static. So that's my initial first round thoughts. Brad, what are your initial first round thoughts on book cover design?
Boy, oh boy, I'm going to co-sign all of that. Number one, I think a cover has to tell a story.
Okay. Yep.
So if you just have like all of your characters just standing around, or all of your characters just like walking in a hallway or something, that doesn't tell me a story. Like if it's a high school type of thing and they're just walking in a high school hallway, that's not much of a story. I want there to be some element of drama. I want there to be a significance of a moment in that cover. I want something, it much like a comic, I want something to happen. Okay. And just having your character standing there or lined up, unless the lineup is significant. In other words, think of the movie poster for the Usual Suspects. Right. That in that regard, a lineup tells a story. But otherwise, it might not. And I want that cover to tell a story. So that's number one. And that coming from a guy that spent many, many books just doing a cover that involved like a cheesecakey kind of single image on the cover, like one figure on the cover. And I was thinking that would just sell it. And it really didn't. And it wasn't because that it wasn't well drawn, although I think the ones later on got better. It wasn't because of any of that. It was because that didn't say anything. It didn't tell me why I want to buy this book. And later on, when I would create these images in which I had a whole lot of stuff going on that exemplified what the book was all about, then I think those covers performed a lot more strongly than some of the other ones did. So that's number one. Number two, when especially since you're going to be paying for offset printing, unless you're going like print on demand, and even then, I think most print on demand lets you go full bleed on the covers. Do a full bleed cover. In other words, don't do this thing where the cover is blue and then your illustration appears in a box inside the blue field. You know what I'm trying to explain there?
Right.
Your image, in my opinion, should go all the way to the outside of the page. And in fact, actually go further, and then it gets trimmed off, which is what a full bleed is all about. And in my personal aesthetic, whenever possible, I like to have that front cover illustration wrap around to the back cover. Because let's face it, there's not a lot going on the back cover. In fact, in a minute, we're going to talk about back cover, and I've got a lot of thoughts on that I got a feeling Dave and I are going to disagree a little bit. So that's going to be fun. So I'll set that table right now.
I like when you go to a certain voice. Oh, that's going to be fun. We're going to argue about that.
We're going to have a disagreement.
Oh, I'm going to get so angry at David. That's going to be delightful.
Stay tuned to hear Mommy and Daddy fight. Oh, I slipped into a little Gilbert Gottfried there just then. I didn't even know I could do that. Stay tuned. We'll be talking about the back cover very soon. I like that front cover to wrap around to the back cover. I don't know that anybody cares about that except me, but I love it when that happens. What are your thoughts about that, Dave?
I have never, I'll be honest, like 99% of humanity, I have not cared about a back cover. And so I tend to not care if there's a wraparound. Like, it's usually 5 seconds of interest and I go, oh, they made a wraparound. Well, here I go. And right into the book. I didn't even care, you know. But yeah. To Brad's point, there is something interesting and visually fun about a wraparound. It's certainly better than what I do, which is here are three comics. Here's some body copy. Here's the title copy again. And here's the UPC. Yeah. All right. And we're out. You know, that kind of thing. But in terms of importance, because I've watched literally 1,000 people pick up and examine a book at a Comic-Con, which, by the way, is great training for how to design a cover. Because you see which of your covers, of which I have like 15 now, you see which one draws people to your table. And it's a great lesson to see how they pick up a book. And here's the order of what they tend to do. They look at a cover for 1 to 2 seconds, and then they immediately flip open to the middle, right? That's 80% of people's experience. They don't even go to the back of the book. The back of the book is usually after they've read 5 or 10 pages, and then they flip to the back to look at the price, and that's it. So just in terms of importance, know that the back of the book is literally the redheaded stepchild of what sells a book. You know, nothing, it's not going to make or break the deal. So you want to put all your focus and all your energies on the front of the book. If you have a clever idea, don't save it for the back. That's what I'm getting at. Put it on the front. Mm-hmm. Another thing that I would say to Brad, or to Brad's point, in terms of making a kinetic, energetic pose interesting, is learn from the masters. And one cheat that I have often taken from the Renaissance masters is the idea of making a composition in a triangle. And if you're not familiar with this as a term, just take 15, 20 minutes and Wikipedia triangle composition in Renaissance paintings or triangle compositions in painting, or frankly, even in photos. One of the most famous photos of all time the raising of the American flag over Iwo Jima by the 5 or 6 soldiers.
Oh, yeah.
There are 2 active triangles if you look at that photo.
Yeah.
And that's why compositionally it is so dramatic and so interesting, because the mm-hmm. flag and the edge points of the photo make 1 triangle. And then the 3 or 4 or 5 guys, I don't remember how many are in it, they themselves are perfectly triangulated. And so the Mona Lisa works on a triangle. Like 9 out of 10 Pietas that have been painted or sculpted are in a triangle with the mother and child. And so in general, a triangle is a very effective way for your eye to have both balance and counter energy against 3. You know, each point is fighting against the other 2 points in the triangle. And so there's an interesting yeah. form of both balance and energy between them. So I would learn from that. And then my last thing that we haven't really talked about is colors. And for this, I would strongly recommend learning from billions of dollars of advertising and see what colors work. Now, it's not an accident that Burger King, Coca-Cola, McDonald's all use red, yellows, and whites in their advertising. Those are all very mm-hmm. strong advertorial colors and work really well for both eye-catching. But sometimes that can be too strong on a bookshelf or in a book. You know, sometimes you want a subtler tone. And for that, just look at color families and color blocks that you've seen in advertising that you really responded to, that gave you a mood that you like, and work some of those into your cover. Brad, what do you think about that? You, as a colorblind person, I shouldn't go too far deep in this, but I'll let you talk, Brad.
Absolutely. I love what you just said about color and about the triangular composition. And I'm just going to add one more thought, and that is to spend a little bit of extra time on your typography. Get a nice font. Get something that's not, you know, Times New Roman or Helvetica. Get something that, and don't. This is for all of you comics artists and cartoonists out there. Don't use a dialogue hand lettering font. In other words, don't use Comic Sans, but don't use the font that you would use inside of a word balloon.
Oh, what a great point.
I see that all the time, and it's always horrible.
While we're on fonts, Brad, let me say one more thing about fonts. So if you want to trust both Brad and I, Brad, who worked in newspaper layout, I, who worked in package design in Mattel Toys,
yeah.
trust me when I say this. Never on a cover use more than 3 different types of fonts, and ideally keep it down to 2 if you can.
Yes.
Because what
yes.
happens is you start to look like a crazy person if you have more than 3 fonts. Legitimately, there's a reaction that people have like, nah, when they have too many fonts. Yeah. You're like, what's going on here? And you lose both communication force and you lose efficacy. So don't go above yes. 3 fonts in your cover design.
I'd say keep it to 2 and make sure that those...
I would too. Yeah, no, I honestly would keep it to 2.
And make sure that those 2 fonts work well together. And here's the
deal.
Right,
because you're creating a font family and yes. they have to play off each other.
Yes. And so don't ever use a hand lettering font that you would use inside of a word balloon as your title font. Again, I've seen it 100 times and it stinks every time. Go to Blambot. Go to comic fonts, comicbookfonts.com. Go and find a nice display font, a nice headline font, a nice font that might even be used for like a sound effect. I would even go into some of those.
Yep.
And display, use that as big display, and they'll have them categorized as display fonts. Use those. They're big. They're bold. They're meant to be played at a large size. Those dialogue fonts, those word balloon fonts, the hand lettering, that's specifically built to look good small. And when you make it too big, it's not so great. Okay? So use that and then put a little bit of time into it. Just don't put the font in there. Put a little art into that font, either whether you're outlining the letters or, you know, doing something to make them stand out a little bit. And I'm telling you, you'd have to put a gun to my head before I'd put, I shouldn't say that, but I put a little extra time in your font, even if it means putting it on a curved baseline instead of just a straight baseline where it just goes straight across. That may not work best for your composition. So consider doing a curved baseline or type on a path or something like that. So that the main reason is that font, that headline has got to work and interplay with the image of the cover. And having a straight across line might not be the best way to do that. So right, keep that right. option open as well.
And then I will put, I'm surprised by how many thoughts I have about covers. But anyway, I will put one last big capstone on my thoughts, which is don't shuff off the idea of doing research either. And here's what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
Comics over the last 70 years have produced a shit ton of covers because they had to produce mm-hmm. one every month, you know, and there's a billion titles every month. And so take a lesson from all these wonderful covers that have been produced over comics and all the terrible covers that have been produced for comics. Mm-hmm. And so here's what you do. Once you know that you have a certain cover in mind, and so for me with Drive, I know on the last cover that I wanted to communicate both that it's in space, that there are spaceships, that there's a crew of five or six, that there are aliens involved, that there's menace. So then I know, okay, I need to go with a cover that shows multiple characters telling a story in space. All right, so I'm going to look at maybe Star Wars. I'm going to look at Guardians of the Galaxy. I'm going to look at a thousand covers from when the X-Men went out into space in the 80s, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so what I did was once I had a certain cover in mind, a family of covers in mind, then I started researching, and it's just Google image search, you know, best comics mm-hmm. covers, X-Men, 80s, best comic covers, Guardians of the Galaxy, late 70s, early 90s, whatever, you know, whatever it is. And you'll start to see a family of comic covers that you're like, oh, okay, I see what they're all trying to do here. So I'm going to incorporate this thrust, this idea, this approach for designing a cover into what I want to do. It's not that you're cribbing from it. You're just saying, oh, I see how they structured these characters better from the waist up because I want to do this. Oh, better to do a full body shot because I'm going to be showing action. Oh, better to have a tableau of, semi-transparent objects in the background because it shows the overall world. Whatever it is that you want to do, take a lesson from the comics covers that have come before you and see what works. That's my short version is see what works. And incorporate those approaches into your design.
Cool hunting is what you've called it in Pro Tips.
Cool hunting. That's it. I didn't even use my own phrase, Brad. Yes. Do some cool hunting, both in shops and online. Like you can go and see what the best of the best is right now in shops and what the best of all time have been by doing Google image searches.
Absolutely. And since I promised to fight, I don't think we're actually going to fight. Talking quickly about the back cover, you need to have your price there. And that means you got to put some thought into your price. And when I say need to, that means if you've got any thoughts of being distributed with this book, if this book is going to appear in retail outlets at any point during its life, it's got to have a price printed on the back of it. It has to have a barcode printed on the back of it that features that price. So it means that you got to think long and hard about that price because it's got to be high enough so that after you sell it to a distributor for as much as 65% off the cover price, you still have enough money left over to make a profit. But what I wanted to get at was this. Dave, how important do you think a endorsement quote is on the back cover? Because I know a lot of people put a lot of time and energy running out. Oh, please write a cover for write a quote for my book. I need it for the back cover. How important do you think an endorsement quote is for the back cover?
Well, Brad, I'm going to tell you something that may shock you. I have never in my life bought a book that didn't have an endorsement quote on the back. It's got to have an endorsement quote or I don't buy it. I got to tell you.
Oh my God. I'm rubbing off on you.
Everyone was saying, Dave, you're going to love Lord of the Rings. And I was like, I don't want to buy it unless it's got a quote from Neil Gaiman on the cover telling me that I'm going to love Lord of the Rings. Hey, Dave, you're going to love this science fiction book called Dune. Nope. I don't want to hear it unless Asimov has a quote on the cover saying he loved the book. I'm not buying it. I'm not even looking at it. Just get me that quote. No, here's the thing. Quotes and recommendation blurbs that go on the covers are a result of mass market books that editors were doing anything they could to get that book into your hand and distinguish itself from another 1,000 books on the market. they don't really work, I don't think. I mean, unless it's a quote, like if I saw a book and it had a quote that said like, boy, I love this Brad Geiger. He's an amazing person. God. Then you'd be like, well, all right, yeah. God gave a quote.
I better listen to God. The last book that God wrote is still in sales. So I got to listen to this guy.
I tell you what, he's a bestseller. I'm going to pick this up. No, like I will be honest. There are a few authors. Like if Bill Watterson came out of nowhere and like, oh, I love this thing, then I would be like, oh, all right, right. Well, I'll check it out. You know, but there are very few people for whom their opinion would sway my opinion. I either love the book or I don't, and so right. I have a very low value that I place on quotes on a book.
Yeah,
you can do it. It's not going to hurt you. But I don't know, frankly, that it's going to help you as much as you think it would. Basically, what it is, too, it's also a little bit artists feeling imposter syndrome, unless they're like, oh, but you know, thank God at least somebody else thinks I'm great. And so here's a quote, you know?
Right. And remember, those quotes, those endorsements, those were a holdover from an age at which people bought their books in bookstores. And that's just not how, by and large, that's not how your book is likely to be sold. Your book is not going to be on a bookshelf. It's either going to be sold through Kickstarter, it's sold through your website, or it's going to probably be sold through Amazon.com. Those bookshelf aesthetics are less, in my opinion, less and less important.
Yeah, it's equivalent if you want to play a different mental game to album cover art.
Yeah,
like remember when that was super important in the 70s and 80s and 90s, Brad? Nobody cares anymore.
Yes,
like once in a while, I'll download a file from the iTunes store and it like accidentally didn't cover with the cover art, and I'm like, who cares? Don't need it. Just wanted the music.
Yeah, exactly.
Not going to go hunting for it. I could care less. And yet in the 70s, if you didn't have amazingly cool and interesting album cover, then you were, you know, that's why the White Album was so interesting, because the Beatles were like, oh, no, it's just about the music.
Yeah.
And which speaks to the fact that how important album cover artwork was back then. To Brad's point, we don't sell books that way anymore. So a lot of the old rules don't necessarily apply. And so you don't necessarily have to mimic what is no longer important.
Right. Just in case anybody's hearing that and getting confused, the front cover still very important,
especially for
a visual image like a graphic novel. But some of those things that you see being done because it's always been done, give it a little extra thought and ask, does this still really have value in today's market or in the market in which my book is going to be? And you might just find out that it's not.
Brad's absolutely right with the last part there. It's not even what the market does. It's what your specific audience will need in order to make a decision to buy that book.
Yes. Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute and stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, Brad and I are going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
Yeah, because, you know, when you do, you'll get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And an exclusive Patreon post that go even deeper on the Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, no worries.
You can still support the show by rating us wherever you get podcasts.
Leave us a 5-star review and a few kind words.
And that, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
And now, let's talk comics. Hey, Dave, we got time for another $5 question, and it's from our friend Jonathan Small. You want to hear it?
Not only do I want to hear it, I'm leaning a little bit closer to the microphone, Bradley, so I can hear the question.
I can tell. You had garlic for breakfast this morning. All right, Jonathan writes...
Wait a minute. Who has garlic for breakfast? In what world am I fighting Draculas? What am I doing?
On your eggs? A little garlic on your eggs is not bad.
I tell you what, Brad, nothing livens up the flavor of bacon like garlic. Oh, I don't... Without 7 cloves, I don't even touch a piece of bacon.
I love it. I put garlic on anything but ice cream. I'm telling you that right now. That's a good thing.
Oh, God. I don't even touch my Fruit Loops unless there's 6 whole cloves of garlic in there.
And it better be fresh. None of this out of the can garlic. Oh, right. Man. So Jonathan writes, do you ever buy ads for your webcomics? Boost posts? Is that decision purely mercenary, or do you factor in artistic purity and ethics? So Dave, one of the most artistically pure people that I know, do you buy ads and why or why not?
That feels like a big insult on the DL. Well, why did you have to say one of the most artistically pure people I know? That felt like a real shiv in the back. I don't know what that was.
I meant that. No, the garlic was a shiv. It was a hint, for Christ's sake. But no, the... but the other part was genuine.
It felt like a mob boss about to push me off a bridge. I tell you what, one of the most artistically pure people I ever met. Look at this guy.
One of the most artistically pure people I've ever met. Why, thank you, Rock.
I like that you went with Rocco as the name. Anyway, all right, so let's talk ads, because this is an interesting inflection point. Now, I know you're going to get articles out there that are like, oh, SEO, you can boost things with a certain purchase of this or that at the right time.
Yep.
And here's the thing. That mood always strikes you at a moment of insecurity. And so I will say, in a very human moment, have I bought ads in the past? Yep. Did they work? Nope. Was it a waste of money? Yes.
Yep.
And so those are the short versions of that. Here's the thing, is that a lot of those ad networks are set up so that it really is only effective if you're spending tens of thousands of dollars, in which case their own internal algorithms boost up your ad placement and interaction and all that sort of stuff. But a lot of what you're seeking can be done with more effective cartooning and more effective communication around your cartooning, rather than paying for artificial interest. Because really what you're doing with an ad is, even if it works, for example, even if it works and you get more eyeballs coming to whatever it is, your comic, your book, your blog, your new t-shirt, whatever it is, unless the thing itself is good, it was all for naught. So better to make the thing good and get natural interest in the thing than to get artificial interest into a thing that people go, oh, yeah, and then click away from.
Yeah.
But that's my first pass thought. What are your thoughts?
100% cosine, retweet, high five. That's everything.
We are the oldest of men.
No, I agree with everything you said. Number one, I bought very, very few ads in my time, had the exact same experience. And making a cost-effective purchase with your ad money is really difficult, because you've got to really know, not only like, okay, what should the ads, where should it be placed? And at what time should it be placed? And how many impressions you need? That's one whole art and science that we just don't have. You'd need to bring somebody in to consult on something like that, number one. Number two, now you're building an ad, and now you've got to decide what your message is and what your visual messaging should be and what that message should say and how it should be composed. And that's a whole nother art and science that we think we've got, but we don't. We think, it's just like doing a cartoon. I'll just do that. Wrong. You're wrong. It's not. It's a whole different thing. And you don't have those skills either. In other words, what I'm trying to say is, at our level, we don't have the skill set to spend money efficiently and effectively. We're just going to be throwing our money away, putting together crappy ads and putting them up at a time that is either time and or a place that is absolutely useless. So it's a complete waste of money to be doing this, unless, like Dave says, you got 10 G's that you can put into this without blinking, then that's another thing altogether. And also, the other thing I want to underline is, Dave says it can be done better by, number one, doing a good comic. There's a theme we haven't hit on this show for a while, but it's always underneath. If you're doing a good comic, you can't keep people away from it. That's the best advertising you can ever get, is by doing a good comic. Concentrate on doing that, and it's way better than spending ad money. And number two, if you're using social media wisely, in other words, you see all the time people flailing around on social media. They'll on Twitter, they'll say, hey, my comic just updated. It's over at this other place. Can't read it here. If you click on this, you can go to another place and you can go read the comic.
boo, that's a failure. Or you'll get a tweet that says, the comic updated, and then it's a link. And it's like, you can't say anything more interesting than the comic updated. I saw one guy done a whole video. It had explosions and it had the music and then the camera would pan over top of this art way, way too close to the art. And you couldn't tell what was going on. All you could tell was that it was lines and colors, you know, and it was, say, scrolling past these scenes that had no context and no meaning. And then the video ended with, go read this comic at another place that isn't here. And I looked at that incredulously, and I'm like, are you serious? I just watched this video so you could tell me to go read the comic at another place, and all you gave me was these weird images. What I'm trying to say is, if you use social media wisely, if you put the comic up on social media so people can read it, and you're doing a good comic, that is worth any amount of advertising that you can afford to spend on it. That is going to give you all kinds of eyeballs. That's going to give you all kinds of distribution and all kinds of exposure. If you're using social media wisely, my theory is you don't need to spend penny number one on advertising, because if you're doing organic reach, and that's the stuff that you reach on social media without spending any money to boost posts and stuff like that. Problem with advertising is as soon as you stop spending advertising money, that traffic goes away. In other words, I've had people and they've done consultations that they've hired me to do. Right. And they're like, oh, I've got to keep paying for advertising because it's keeping my numbers up on this place. And it's like, yeah, but you're not converting that into book sales. You're not converting that into Kickstarter. You're not converting that. You're just, all you're getting is numbers. And they're like, no, but it's important. I got to keep doing it. And I'm like, it's not giving you actual readers. And the guy says, well, prove that to me. I said, I'll prove it to you. Stop paying for it for a week. See where those numbers go. And he said, I'll do that. He says, you'll see. He stopped paying for the week. His numbers bottomed out. He wasn't getting any traffic. That's because all the people that were coming across to take a look at that comic was jumping right back out, because there was a lot of problems with the comic itself. That goes down to stuff that we talk about on the show all the time. As soon as he stopped paying for the advertising, the traffic stopped. He was retaining zero readers through that advertising.
Right, right.
So it's not a great idea. And you could do it all by A, like Dave just said, doing a better comic, and B, doing smart use of social media.
Yeah, and so I have two things to build on that. And the first one is this. Many of you might have glossed over what Brad said there, but with great emphasis, Brad used the word incredulously. And I got to tell you, that is today's winner of the $10 word when a 1 cent word would have done the job. Brad using incredulously. Oh, I'm so proud of him. Brad has just won an extra 5 minutes off of his schedule this morning, and he gets to wake up at 4:35 tomorrow instead of at 4:30. So, Brad, you're going to be excited to hear the bird 5 minutes later tomorrow. So that's point number one. Great use of incredulously. That was wonderful.
And five syllables, and I got through them without stuttering. I was proud of myself.
And by the way, you'll notice, I want you guys to go back and re-listen to this, because it was incredulously, like he was making sure he got it right. There was a tiny halting in his voice as he said, he was like, get through this, Bradley, get through it incredulously.
I wrestled that to the ground, baby.
So here's my second thought about advertising, because this is actually an important point. And I will context this in a personal way, because I think it's effective. Right now, I am kickstarting a book, as we mentioned, at newsheldonbook.com. Now, I could go out to every cartoonist I know and say, please retweet, please mention the book, please. Yes. But here's the dirty little secret. It's really only going to be bought by people that already read my comic. So I've got to do the heavy lifting. It's not that Brad can make people buy my book if they're not already a reader. I've got to do it. So imagine if that kind of free advertising and that free endorsement of fellow cartoonists wouldn't help, then imagine how ineffective me buying ads for people that have never seen my comic before. It's going to be to get them to buy the book. You know, it's my job over the next 30 days to find a way to get my message on their social media feed, which is itself a challenge. And then to convince them enough times so that they've heard it 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times. And they go, you know what? Yes, I do enjoy Sheldon and I would like to buy this book. So really, the onus is on me. It's not on other cartoonists. It's not on other people spreading the word, although that helps. There is a percentage that does buy it. It does help. But the onus for 95% of the sales is on me. And even advertising wouldn't help that, I don't think.
Yep. And please, you know, that's a nice little tangent. I see this whole, please retweet, please share on social media posts all the time. And I always get the same thought when I look at that. And that is, instead of saying, please retweet, why don't you say something worth retweeting? Why don't you say something that's so interesting that I want to retweet it because I want to have that on my feed? Why not say something that's interesting or captivating or clever or any number of things so that you don't have to ask me. My first thought is, oh my God, I need to retweet that because it's so good.
Yep.
That's where your aim should be. Not with all this mealy mouth, please retweet, please share. How about sharing something how about posting something that's worth sharing? And you see Dave do this all the time. In fact, I'm telling you right now, if you don't follow this guy on Twitter or Instagram, this is a good time to follow Dave and just take notes because you're going to see him posting a lot of stuff in the next 30 days. Some of it is just marking time stuff. Hey, we're at this percentage. Hey, we're at that percentage. And you need to do that stuff too. Some of the stuff he's going to tweet over this next 30 days is going to be actually interesting stuff. It's going to be clever thoughts and it's going to be stuff that people are going to retweet and reshare because they want to. It's a good time to watch Dave because I think you're absolutely failing
over the next 30 days.
Now you've got, I was thinking as I was saying that's a little unfair to say to you because now you've got a lot of pressure, but you've been doing this for decades now. I've been following you for a long time. I think I can make that prediction. But yeah, in general, watch somebody like a Dave Kellett and watch how he's going to parse this in the next 30 days. You're going to see a lot of stuff that you're going to want to share because it's worth sharing.
Well, thank you for that, Brad. I hope it goes all right. It's funny because whenever you do a Kickstarter, it's always having done 8 or 9 of them now. There's always the big burst out the gate and there's always the last final days, the last final 3 to 4 days, which are also a burst. But then no matter who you are and how successful your Kickstarter is going, the middle 15 days are among the most trying emotionally of your artist imposter syndrome, where you're like, gotta keep generating interest. Gotta create something interesting. So tired. Want to stop talking about myself. Hate talking about myself this much.
I hate myself.
Yeah, I hate myself. Literally, yeah.
One of our Comic Lab backers called that the bathtub curve because it starts on one side way up in the air and then it plummets down and it goes straight across and then at the end it jets right back up in the air again and then ends. And it looks like the side view of a bathtub, which I always thought was a great way of putting it. But yeah, that's Kickstarter. And those middle 15 days are torture.
Oh, I hate it. I hate it so much. But it's part of the gig. You know, you got to do it. And yeah. This one will be, I think, so Drive has established a certain level and Sheldon Books have established a certain level. And I think this one will turn out just fine for a Sheldon book. So it'll be a good campaign, I think. But
and you'll do the whole thing without buying any ads.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, exactly. That's the button. I think that's the perfect button on that point, Brad, is that I will not be buying any ads because, frankly, you're spending money to try to convince people that they should already have been willingly already turned towards for free based on all the free comic and content you've given them over the months and years prior.
Well, listen, Dave, this is a good place for me to tell you that you've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
And your hosts have been the always incredulous Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And the hyperbolic Dave Kellett, co-director of Stripped and cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com. Drive at drivecomic.com and check out that Kickstarter. I'm going to say it one more time. Sheldon, you can find that book at newsheldonbook.com.
And the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode was edited by Matt Woodard at Woodsong Productions at www.woodsong.media.
Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll say that twice, patreon.com/comiclab. Yeah, and when you share that link, of course, the link you're sharing is newsheldonbook.com.
Right now, I am kickstarting a book, as we mentioned, at newsheldonbook.com.
Do you have any metrics on how that's working out?
What, with newsheldonbook.com? Well, the thing
is... newsheldonbook.com, yeah.
No, I was going to tell you about newsheldonbook.com instead of New Sheldon. Yeah. But anyway.
No, I agree. That's why I'm such a big fan of newsheldonbook.com.
All right, I see. I see you, Brad Geiger.
And 7.